Okay then, brethren, we've been looking at the book of Job for a few weeks now, and I think you'll recollect by now that there are, well, at least two meanings, two views you can attach to the book of Job. The traditional view, one I guess we're all fairly familiar with, is, paraphrasing somewhat, that Job was a very self-righteous man, and that God brought tragedy into Job's life, loss of his family, loss of his wealth, sickness, terrible skin disease, to teach him humility. And, you know, technically, some people would say that, well, God used Satan to actually do the physical attacking, but it was all God behind it, and it was God's great sovereign purpose. This is the traditional view. And what lesson do we take from the traditional view? Well, something along the lines of that God, in his mysterious, eternal purpose, may bring suffering into your life, into my life, to teach us, to humble us, to perfect us. Our house may burn down. We may suffer chronic sickness, the death, perhaps, of a loved one, the premature death of a loved one. God may do that to us, like he did to Job. And just like Job, you and I should declare in such circumstances, well, the Lord gives and the Lord takes away. Blessed be the name of the Lord. And, you know, that's sort of the traditional view. I paraphrased slightly there, but that's, I think, broadly how it looks. Now, I've offered an alternative view, which is a bit different. And I've said that if you take the overall context of the Bible, not just looking just purely at the book of Job, but everything from Genesis to Revelation, the Bible shows us that God is a God of love. He's a God of mercy and loving kindness. He's a God whose disposition is to show us goodness and compassion. God is a good shepherd who tends carefully and tenderly to his sheep. He's not a shepherd that takes his best sheep, breaks all its legs, and burns its wool off with an oxyacetylene torch to teach it humility and patience. If you look at the Bible as a whole, that is not a fair reflection of God. And hence, to me, the traditional view doesn't stack up. And that's what we've been looking at the last few weeks. We've seen already two or three times now that it was actually Satan who had Job already in his crosshairs. God asked Job, Satan, have you set your heart on Job? Well, that should be no surprise to us, because what Satan did then is precisely what he's still doing today. Remember the scripture that says that Satan goes about as a roaring lion seeking whom he may devour? He had his heart set on Job. His heart's also set on you and me. And Satan was completely free to attack Job, just as he's completely free to attack you or me. Hence, we're told many times in scripture to be vigilant, to be watchful, to resist the devil strong in the faith, to put on the whole armor of God that we may be able to stand against him, because he's out there and he's looking. As he was then, so is he today. Now, it's possible we've suggested that Job may have thought that because he was an upright and a moral man, that he was automatically protected from harm and calamity. Well, he wasn't. And neither are you or me. That would be presumptuousness on our part. And then getting to last week, we saw Job's three friends had arrived to comfort him, to encourage him, sort of. Eliphaz, Bildad, and Zophar. And what we see then in the book of Job was about 29 chapters of argument and disagreement between Job and his three friends. They all disputed with each other. And although we have an inspired record of what they said, it is not truth. These 29 chapters from Job and the three friends of his are opinions of men. They are theologies of men. There's loads of hot air. It's an inspired record, but it does not contain God's truth. Can't do. They contradict and disagree with each other. Now, last week, we took time to review the thoughts, opinions, and views of Job's three friends. And in a nutshell, their theology was really in two parts. Number one, God sends suffering and calamity on wicked people. That was their fundamental view. God sends calamity on wicked people. Secondly, Job's calamities were clear evidence he was wicked. That's how they saw it. And they spent many chapters trying to convince Job to own up, to fess up. Now, of course, Job totally denied that. He said, no way. You know, I may not be perfect, but I'm a good man. I don't deserve any of this. That's wrong. I am not an evil, wicked man. So let's have a quick recap. We'll look at four places just to refresh our understanding of what the basis of Job's friends' views were. Let's look at Job 4, read verses 7 to 9. Job chapter 4, verses 7 to 9. And if you colour the early parts of each chapter, you can more or less easily see who's talking. This one tells us in verse 1 it's Eliphaz. And you know, if you're reading the words of Eliphaz or Bildad or Zophar, that God was extremely angry with these guys. They did not speak of him what was right. So when you and I are reading the book of Job, or somebody refers to Job chapter X, verse Y, we should be cautious. If it's quoting Job 38 or 39, well, that's God speaking. Now that we can believe, that's true truth. But quoting Job 4 or Job 5, Eliphaz, he was perhaps sincere and genuine, but God said he didn't speak the truth. But what did he say? Well, picking up in verse 7, remember now, he says to Job, who ever perished being innocent? Right? Answer that, Job. Where were the upright ever cut off? Even as I have seen, those who plough iniquity and sow trouble reap the same. By the blast of God they perish, by the breath of his anger they are consumed. So Eliphaz is quite blunt. Job, you have ploughed iniquity, you have sown trouble, you are reaping the consequences of your own terrible conduct. What innocent person has ever perished, Job? Well, of course, the answer is lots of innocent people have perished. So he blames God and he blames Job. And then a bit later on, we'll not read it today, but you remember this is the guy who said that a spirit appeared to him in the night and brought a heavenly message to pass on to Job. Well, nonsense. If there was a spirit, it was from the other side. Okay, look at Job 5 and read verse 17. This is still Eliphaz speaking. Behold, happy is the man whom God corrects. Therefore, do not despise the chastening of the Almighty. So it's quite clear to Eliphaz that this is all God's handiwork. And he's correcting, chastising, and dealing with Job, who clearly is a very, very wicked man. Let's turn to Job 11. Read verses 5 and 6. These are the words of Zophar. Zophar, chapter 11, verses 5 and 6. But oh, that God would speak and open his lips against you, that he would show you the secrets of wisdom, for they would double your prudence. Know therefore that God exacts from you less than your iniquity deserves. Now, there's some encouragement for you, Job. God's been merciful. You deserve a lot worse than you're getting. But the guy's lost his wealth, lost his family. He's sitting in an ash heap covered with boils and skin that's peeling off. And his friend, Zophar, says, you deserve more. This is less than your iniquity deserves. So, I mean, their theology was, you know, bad things happen to bad people. You've got bad things happening. You're a bad person. You're a really, really bad person to have this much trouble come upon you, this much calamity. It's clear evidence. It's proof positive to us wise men that you really, Job, must be an appalling individual. You've got God up against you to such a level that you must be wickedness personified. Bad, bad, bad. Now, of course, you know, we know that actually God said that Job was an upright man, that he shunned, eschewed evil, feared God. That was God's view, was Job was a pretty good guy. And now they're saying you're a wicked person. So they're way out of step with, you know, God's view of Job. Let's look at Job 15, which is Eliphaz back again. Eliphaz looks like he was probably the elder because he has more chapters devoted to his views. And he was the first one to speak, so I guess he's the senior figure here. So Job 15, let's read verses 5 to 6. For your iniquity teaches your mouth, and you choose the tongue of the crafty. Your own mouth condemns you, not I. Yes, your own lips testify against you. So, you know, out of the abundance of the heart, the mouth speaks, and they're saying, well, your wickedness is clear from the words you're saying. It's a great giveaway. Your heart is full of wickedness and iniquity and wrong and evil. We can tell that just by your conversation. Dropping down to verses 20 to 21. The wicked man writhes with pain all his days. And of course, poor old Job is writhing in pain, so they're putting two and two together and getting 5 3/4 here. The wicked man writhes with pain all his days, and the number of years is hidden from the oppressor. Dreadful sounds are in his ears. In prosperity, the destroyer comes upon him. And they're probably alluding to when Job was a prosperous man, more prosperous than any man of the East, and destruction came upon him. Why? Because, verse 20, he's a wicked man. Look at verse 25. For he stretches out his hand against God and acts defiantly against the Almighty. So Job, you're an example of wickedness. You're hostile to God. You act defiantly against God. You are a wicked, wicked person. And we read lots of other places last week, all pretty much covering the same material. All of Job's three friends were in basic agreement. Job was wicked, and he absolutely deserved everything that happened to him. And yet, you know, when we get to Job 42, verse 7, we read that God picked on Eliphaz and said his wrath was aroused against these three friends because they had not spoken correctly about him. So Eliphaz and Bildad and Zophar, they've got views, happy to attack Job about their views, happy to attribute all manner of motives to God for what he's doing, but they were wildly inaccurate. Now, I'm sure at times they said something that was, you know, broadly true, but it was a mixture of some truth and a whole bunch of foolishness, inaccuracy, and human observations and human views and human theology. So in a sense, like I've said several times now, we'd be cautious about putting too much weight on anything these guys say, as indeed we would in what Job says. And today we're going to review what Job's views were, what Job's opinions were, because, of course, you know, Job completely rejected the views of his friends. I mean, he knew basically that he was a good man, and that was accurate. I don't think for a moment he believed he was, you know, perfect. He never claimed to be perfect, but he knew that he was fundamentally a good guy. He knew he was disciplined, that he was generous, that he'd been very wise, that he looked after people, that he'd carefully controlled his eyes and where they looked. He was not a covetous man. He was not a licentious man. He knew that, you know, by and large, he was a pretty decent, upstanding guy. And he wasn't wrong, because God said the same. An upright man, a moral man, who fears God and shuns evil. So we shouldn't be too harsh on Job thinking he's some horrible, super disgusting, self-righteous guy. His opinion of himself was pretty much, you know, fair. And yet, God was after him. Why? That just wasn't fair. That's what Job was troubled by. How could God bring this calamity on him? Because, of course, Job also believed it was God behind it. None of these four characters seemed to hit on the fact that it was Satan. And perhaps, to be fair, they didn't know much about Satan. I don't know. They all believed anyway that it was God, and of course that was completely wrong in all four parties' parts. Okay, let's turn to Job 6. Job chapter 6. Pick up what Job himself makes of all of this. Job 6, and reading verses 1 through 4. Then Job answered. So what you got was, you know, Eliphaz would speak, Job would reply. Bildad would speak, Job would reply. Zophar would speak, Job would reply, and of course reply and generally attempt to repudiate everything said by his friends. Verse 1. Then Job answered and said, "Oh, that my grief were fully weighed, and my calamity laid with it in the balances. For then it would be heavier than the sand of the sea. Therefore my words have been rash, for the arrows of the Almighty are within me. My spirit drinks in their poison. The terrors of God are arrayed against me." So very early on in the book of Job, he's absolutely blaming God for what's happened. Verse 4, "The arrows of the Almighty are within me, and my body's absorbing their poison." It's God who's done this. Now, Job believed that, and in a sense he was, sincere, no question. Of course, he was sincerely wrong, because we know from Job chapter 1 and 2, it was Satan. Look at verses 8 and 9. "Oh, that I might have my request, that God would grant me the thing that I long for, that it would please God to crush me, that he would loose his hand and cut me off." When it says crush me, one translation says go ahead and kill me. "Oh, that God would go ahead and kill me." Another translation says, "Oh, that God would do away with me." Or like it says, see the New King James, that he would crush me, put an end to me. Because Job's just thinking, I've lost my wealth, I've lost my family, I've lost my health, I'm in pain and anguish, I'm doomed. If only God would just put me out of my misery. Why can't God kill me and have it done with? And I guess you couldn't really blame him from where he was. If he wants to continue living like this, you've lost everything and your health is terrible, you're in pain and anguish, your friends are busy running you down as well, end it all. Do away with me. Verse 14. "To him who's afflicted, kindness should be shown by his friend." And he obviously is saying, you lot, yeah, when you see me here, my affliction, should be a bit of mercy, not just attacking me as well. "To him who's afflicted, kindness should be shown by his friend, even though he forsakes the fear of the Almighty." Drop down to verse 24. Teach me, and I'll hold my tongue. Cause me to understand wherein I have erred. He's talking to his friends. You know, show me where I've gone wrong, and I'll be quiet. Cause me to understand where I've missed it. You know, show me where I've erred, where have I sinned. You know, tell me, where's the evidence? You know, what have I done, guys? You're there. You're supposed to be helping me. Well, if there's something in my life that has brought this about, show me. If you do, then I'll be quiet. I'll accept it. Of course, they couldn't, could they? A, they weren't smart enough, and B, of course, Job was actually a good and upright man. So they would have struggled because there wasn't anything there to find. Look at Job chapter 7. Job chapter 7, let's read verses 4 to 11. Job chapter 7, verses 4 down to 11. When I lie down, I say, when shall I arise and the night be ended? For I've had my fill of tossing till dawn. So he couldn't sleep at night. Just rolled over, tossed and turned, and pain and discomfort and nightmares. And so, he wanted to wake up. When he was awake, he wanted to go to sleep. My flesh is caked with worms and dust. My skin is cracked and breaks out afresh. So he's in a pretty sorry state. Skin's cracked, perhaps, bleeding and, maggots and who knows what not. So pretty horrible. My days are swifter than a weaver's shuttle and are spent without hope. Oh, remember that my life is a breath. My eye will never again see good. The eye of him who sees me will see me no more. While your eyes are upon me, I shall no longer be. I'm fading away. I'll soon be gone. As the cloud disappears and vanishes away, so he who goes down to the grave does not come up. He shall never return to his house, nor shall his place know him anymore. So I'm doomed. I'm going to disappear. No one will ever see me again. My time is up. My life is over. What misery, what woe. Verse 11, therefore I will not restrain my mouth. I will speak in the anguish of my spirit. I will complain in the bitterness of my soul. So he says, I'm justified to complain because I'm fading away. Life is horrible. I'll soon be gone. And I'm not happy. And I want to complain and be miserable and tell people about it. And again, which of us could really blame him? Look at verses 17 to 21. What is man, he's talking now to God, what is man that you should magnify him, that you should set your heart on him? And it says set your heart on him. That's a similar sort of phrase as we saw in Job chapter 1, where God said to Satan, have you set your heart on Job? It has a sort of an implication of an evil purpose. And so what Job's saying here is, why do you set your heart, God, with an evil purpose on mankind? What's behind this attitude of yours towards mankind? Verse 18, he's obviously thinking of himself, that you should visit him every morning and test him every moment. How long? Will you not look away from me and let me alone till I swallow my saliva? Have I sinned? What have I done to you, O watcher of men? Why have you set me as your target so that I'm a burden to myself? Why then do you not pardon my transgression and take away my iniquity? For now I will lie down in the dust and you will seek me diligently, but I will no longer be. Or one translation says, soon you won't find me because I'll be dead. So there you go, God. I'm dying, I'll be dead soon, then you can go looking for me. You won't find me, I'll be dead. in a grave. So he's talking to God now, and obviously he's quite unhappy. You know, why has God set his heart in an evil way upon poor old Job? Verse 20, what have I done to you, O watcher of men? Why have you set me as your target? Why are you after me this way, so that I'm a burden to myself? The original Hebrew may have read, so I'm a burden to you. Why am I burdensome to you? Why don't you pardon my iniquity, my transgression, if I have transgressed? So, ends verse 21, I'm going to lie down in the dust, going to the grave. You can look for me then if you want, God, but you won't find me, I'll be dead. And it serves you right. This is his view, right? And he's convinced, it's quite obvious, there's not one iota of doubt in Job's mind that God is the problem. God has singled him out to attack him in a horrendous way. It's definitely God. There's no question it's God. It's absolutely God. Must be God. The only question that Job's got is, why? Why? What wickedness have I done to deserve this from God? I don't get it. Job chapter 9. Job 9, let's read verses 1 through 10. Then Job answered and said, truly I know it is so, but how can a man be righteous before God? If one wished to contend or argue with God, he could not answer him one time out of a thousand. God is wise in heart, mighty in strength. Who has hardened himself against God and prospered? So he's just rehearsing in his mind how mighty God is. Verse 5, he removes the mountains and they do not know, when he overturns them in his anger. He shakes the earth out of its place, its pillars tremble. He commands the sun and it does not rise. He seals off the stars. He alone spreads out the heavens and treads on the waves of the sea. He made the Bear, Orion, and the Pleiades, and the chambers of the south. He does great things past finding out. Yes, wonders without number. So fair enough. You know, Job's more than happy to concede, admit that God is mighty and powerful, brilliant. What a creator, what a marvel. But, verse 14 through 17, how then can I answer him and choose my words to reason with him? For though I were righteous, I could not answer him. I would beg mercy of my judge. If I called and he answered me, I would not believe that he was listening to my voice. For he crushes me with a tempest and multiplies my wounds without cause. So, even though he's mighty and powerful and glorious in majesty, verse 16, if I called and he would bother to answer me, if he did, but of course you phone God, it's always engaged. That's what Job thought. But if I called and if he answered me, I wouldn't believe he would listen to me because he's crushing me with a tempest, with a hurricane. And he's multiplying my wounds, notice, without cause. God has no reason to do this. What sort of being can he really be? He's mighty and powerful, but he just does this for the sake of it? He just does this to me because he woke up one morning and thought, I'll just go and trample all over Job, shall I? You know, poor old Job just can't figure this out at all. Because he knows there's nothing in his life that deserves this. Yet God's doing it to him. And there's no cause. Verse 21 to 23. I am blameless. I don't think he means, by the way, I'm utterly, supremely perfect. I think it means he knows that he's done nothing of a serious nature that merits anything more than a mild slap in the wrist. So he says, I'm blameless, yet I do not know myself, you know, perfectly. Could be some little thing in there that I've not quite spotted. I am blameless, yet I do not know myself. I despise my life. It is all one thing. Therefore, I say, he destroys the blameless and the wicked. Oh, wow. God doesn't differentiate. God destroys the wicked. Well, that part, perhaps he agrees with, but he says God destroys the blameless and the wicked, both of them. Shows no differentiation. Doesn't honor the blameless. Doesn't look after the blameless. Destroys the blameless as much as the wicked. If the scourge slays suddenly, God laughs at the plight of the innocent.
Arthur Williams.
Oh, dear. Of course, that's why Job later said, I repudiate and take back everything I've said. Because, obviously, he's talking, I think, Elihu says he talks non-stop nonsense. Well, this is it, isn't it? God destroys the blameless and the wicked and shows no differentiation. And God laughs, scoffs, and mocks at the troubles that come upon innocent people. God laughs. It's a great joke to him when innocent people suffer. Of course, that definitely is not the case. And to be fair to Job, when you've been in pain and suffering for quite a while, a number of weeks, at least perhaps a month or two, and your best friends are making even more depressed than when they first arrived, well, Job's starting to get quite mouthy here. Notice verses 32 to 35. For God is not a man as I am, that I may answer him, that we should go to court together. Now, this is what Job would really want. You know, Job's quite convinced in his own mind that he's clean, he's innocent, he's upright. God clearly, from the terrible actions he's taking, thinks Job is wicked, and Job knows he's not wicked. If only he could take God to court. I'm going to sue you, God. See you in court, God. Get your lawyer, God. And we're going to court. We'll get an umpire to look at my position, my life, and what you're doing, and I'm going to be declared innocent. So, you know, fair enough. Verse 32, for he's not a man as I am that I may answer him, that we should go to court together, nor is there any mediator between us who may lay his hand on us both. Let him take his rod away from me, and do not let dread of him terrify me. Then I would speak and not fear him, but it is not so with me. So Job would have liked there to have been a mediator, a go-between, to help represent Job, to help convince God that Job was right. There's a gap here. God is holy and mighty and majestic, and Job is a man. Can't really go to court, can he? But he would love somebody to be there as a mediator, you know, one who could help to bring the parties together. And in a sense, you know, Job is almost here getting around to what Jesus would ultimately be for between God and people like you and me, because Jesus is a mediator. He can represent us to God and God to us. If you hold your place here, we're coming right back. But look at 1 Timothy chapter 2, verses 5 to 6. 1 Timothy 2. 1 Timothy 2, reading verses 5 and 6. Paul writes to Timothy and says, for there is one God and one mediator between God and men, the man Christ Jesus, who gave himself a ransom for all to be testified in due time. So we have God, we have you and me, and we have a mediator, one who can act somewhat as a go-between. Of course, recently we looked at Jesus' role as high priest in the book of Hebrews, one who represents us to God, to whom we can go, is able to save to the uttermost those who come to God through him. So we have a mediator. Job wanted one, and it was probably too early in the history of the world for Job to really know that much. But he could see the need for someone who could be there to help. And of course, we have such a mediator. Okay, let's go back to Job. Pick up in chapter 10. There's a few places in Job where he seems to almost be hinting at something that is off in the future. Perhaps he had a little clue there in the back of his mind. We don't really know how much Job was familiar with in terms of God's ways, because Job lived very, very early on. Way back in the days, well, it could be he's lives in the days of Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, and Jacob's children and then grandchildren, and it looks like Job lived about that time. So it was pre-Moses. There was no book of Genesis or Exodus, Leviticus or Numbers or Deuteronomy. So exactly how much Job knew, we don't know. Certainly something, but not the depth of knowledge that you and I have many, many centuries later. Picking up in Job 10, reading verses 1 through 9. My soul loathes my life. I will give free course to my complaint. I will speak in the bitterness of my soul. Nobody's holding me back. You know, I've got a right to complain. I will say to God, do not condemn me. Show me why you contend with me. What's your problem, God? You know, declare it. Explain. Turn up. You know, show me. Why are you doing this, God? Does it seem good to you that you should oppress, that you should despise the work of your hands and shine on the counsel of the wicked? Do you have eyes of flesh? Do you see as a man sees? Are your days like the days of a mortal man and your years like the days of a mighty man, that you should seek for my iniquity and search for my sin, although you know that I am not wicked? And there's no one who can deliver from your hand. Look, God, you know I'm not wicked. Not just me saying it, God, you know it. I mean, I'm not sure many of us give the confidence about ourselves that Job had, and we know a lot more. But Job was quite convinced, and of course we know that Job was right. He wasn't putting on a pretense here. He wasn't a hypocrite. There wasn't some other story running. God said Job was upright and perfect, man who feared God and, you know, shunned evil. So actually, Job's very fair. God, you know I'm good. Verse 8. Your hands have made me and fashioned me an intricate unity, yet you would destroy me. Remember, I pray, that you have made me like clay. Will you turn me to dust again? What's going on here? Why are you setting out to destroy me, God? I've done nothing that merits this. And you can see the guy is, you know, completely unable to reconcile the horrible calamities and trouble that's come upon him, which must, in his view, be coming from God, with the fact that, by and large, he knows he's a good man, and he knows that God knows he's a good man. So just, you know, it doesn't compute. Okay, moving on to Job 13. Job 13. Reading verses 1 through 5. Behold, my eye has seen all this. My ear has heard and understood it. What he's talking to, I guess, his friends. What you know, I also know. I'm not inferior to you. And I'm sure he didn't think too much of his buddies. You know, what you know, or what you think you know, I also know. I'm not inferior to you, but I would speak to the Almighty and desire to reason with God. But you are forgers of lies. You're worthless physicians. Or that you'd be silent, and that would be your wisdom. Wish you Lord, shut up. He's had it. This bunch, they just talk nonsense. They accuse him endlessly of being a wicked, wicked, wicked man. Well, he knows he's not. They keep telling him why God's doing these things to him, because this is how God deals with wicked people. And he just says, look, you know, I would speak to the Almighty, verse 3. I want to reason with God, but you bunch, You're worthless physicians. You've come here to help me, to encourage me, to make me feel better. I wish you'd shut up. He's had it with these guys. You know, they're not at all helpful to him. Dropping down to verses 15 through 27. Though he slay me, yet will I trust him. Which is a great attitude. I mean, he had a lousy mouth at times, but certainly he couldn't complain about his attitude. He says, even if God kills me, I'll still believe in him. Though he slay me, yet will I trust him. Of course, God wasn't out to slay him. Satan certainly was trying hard enough. But of course, Job thought it was all God's doing. Though he slay me, yet will I trust him. Even so, I will defend my own ways before him. I'm good. I know that. He also shall be my salvation, for a hypocrite could not come before him. Listen diligently to my speech and to my declaration with your ears. See now, I have prepared my case. I know that I shall be vindicated. Whenever I get to court with God, I'm going to be found innocent. Who is he who will contend with me? If now I hold my tongue, I perish. Only two things do not do to me. Then I will not hide myself from you, God. Withdraw your hand far from me, and let not the dread of you make me afraid. Then you call, and I will answer. Or let me speak, then you respond to me. So first of all, God, take your brutal hand off me, so I've got a little bit of peace of mind. And then let's have a conversation. Verse 22 says, you call first if you want, and I'll respond to you. Or, if you want the other way, let me speak to you, God, and you answer me. Well, certainly, you know, he's persistent at least. How many are my iniquities and sins? Make me know my transgression and my sin. Why do you hide your face and regard me as your enemy? You know, just wish God would sort of come clean. Will you frighten a leaf driven to and fro, which is all, you know, Job is? Will you pursue dry stubble? For you write bitter things against me and make me inherit the iniquities of my youth. You put my feet in the stocks. You watch closely all my paths. You set a limit for the soles of my feet. So, poor old Job, God was after him every way he turned. Even though Job was insignificant, just a leaf being blown around by the wind. So why did God go after him that way? Well, you know, how unfair can God really be? Chapter 14, verses 1 and 2. Man who is born of woman is of few days and full of trouble. He comes forth like a flower and fades away. He flees like a shadow and does not continue. Job's just observing that all of us are very temporary. Here today, gone tomorrow. And of course, that's a relatively true statement. So not everything that was said is complete nonsense, but just most of it. So some of these observations are, yeah, fair enough. Yeah, mankind is temporary. You're here for a while, and then they fade away. You know, footballers fade away by the mid-30s.
If they're lucky.
You know, because youth and energy and strength doesn't last that long, does it? So we're all temporary. Yes. Verses 7 to 9. For there is hope for a tree. If it is cut down, it will sprout again, that its tender shoots will not cease. Though its root may grow old in the earth and its stump may die in the ground, yet at the scent of water it will bud and bring forth branches like a plant. So, you know, things like a tree, you can chop them down, but they'll come back again in the right conditions. If the roots are still there and healthy, then fine. You can get a tree to sort of resurrect after a fashion, come back to life again after a fashion. But man dies, verse 10, and is laid away. Indeed, he breathes his last, and where is he? As waters disappears from the sea, and a river becomes parched and dries up, so man lies down and does not rise. Till the heavens are no more, they will not wake, nor be roused from their sleep. So whereas a tree, you might cut it down, break, and come back again. If you cut a man down, end. The book closes. They will not awake. And I guess Job's thinking this through a little bit, but he's obviously making a point that once he's gone, he's gone. So God better make, you know, good use of the time he's around. Verse 13, "Oh, that you would hide me in the grave, that you would conceal me until your wrath is past," which is what poor old Job believes he's experiencing at the present time, "that you'd appoint me a set time," perhaps in the future, "and remember me. Then if a man dies, shall he live again?" It's a great question. If a man dies, shall he live again? People should be thinking of that question, shouldn't they? What do people make of that question out in the world, in North America and South America and Africa and Russia? If a man dies, shall he live again? Excellent question. What's the answer? Well, Job may not have been entirely clear, because it's not coming through clear to me when I read this passage. "For all the days of my hard service, I will wait till my change comes. You shall call, and I will answer you. You shall desire the work of your hands." So it does look like Job has a feeling. He just said a few verses earlier that man dies, and verse 12 doesn't rise till the heavens are no more. They will not wake or be roused from their sleep, which sounds like he thinks it's all over. But then within a verse or two, he thinks, I think he will live again. Verse 14, "If a man dies, shall he live again? All the days of my hard service, I will wait till my change comes. You shall call, and I will answer you. You shall desire the work of your hands." So I get the impression that Job does have a view that he will live again. Now, of course, irrespective of what Job knew or was perhaps a wee bit uncertain of, you and I know a lot more than Job. We've got many places to look. One, we're not turning there, but you could think of 1 Corinthians 15, the resurrection chapter, where we've got, you know, 40 or 50 odd verses telling us about the resurrection. "As in Adam all die, even so in Christ shall all be made alive." So we've got certainty in something that Job was perhaps trying to feel his way around. Moving on to Job 16. Job 16, let's read verses 1 through 5. "Then Job answered and said, I've heard many such things. Miserable comforters are you all." They weren't helping him at all. "You're miserable comforters. Shall words of wind have an end?" You know, your windbags. "Will you ever stop talking nonsense? Or what provokes you that you answer? I also could speak as you do. If your soul were in my soul's place, I could heap up words against you and shake my head at you. But I would strengthen you with my mouth, and comfort, the comfort of my lips would relieve your grief. If I was you and you were me, if I was in your place, I would offer words of encouragement. I would try and relieve your grief if I was you and you were me." He's not very happy with this bunch, is he? And of course, to be fair, they spent a long time insulting the guy, so why should he be very happy with him? Verses 9 through 14, talking of God. "God tears me in his wrath and hates me." Now, we can think of somewhere that says God is love. But Job says God hates me. "He gnashes at me with his teeth. My adversary sharpens his gaze on me. They gape at me with their mouth. They strike me reproachfully on the cheek. They gather together against me. God has delivered me to the ungodly." I think he has in mind his friends. "And turn me over to the hands of the wicked. I was at ease in a former life, enjoying things, but he has shattered me. He also has taken me by the neck and shaken me to pieces. He has set me up for his target. His archers surround me, He pierces my heart and does not pity. He pours out my gall on the ground. He breaks me with wound upon wound. He runs at me like a warrior. So God's really putting the boot in to poor old Job. And notice here that he says that God hates him and that God shows no pity. Does that sound like the true nature of God? Well, that's what, you know, Job in his innocence thought, but of course he was totally wrong. And later on he finds that out. I look at Job 19. Verses 1 through 6. This is the heading in my Bible says Job's response to Bildad. So the previous chapter was Bildad offering certain valuable insights into Job's condition, and Job's now responding. And then Job answered and said, "How long will you torment my soul and break me in pieces with words?" And, you know, people say, you know, sticks and stones may break my bones, but words will never hurt me or harm me. Well, I think Job found these words pretty hurtful. He says, "These 10 times you have reproached me. You are not ashamed that you have wronged me. And if indeed I have erred, my error remains with me. You can't find it. If indeed you magnify yourselves against me and plead my disgrace against me, know then that God has wronged me and has surrounded me with his net." So God's done it. God's in the wrong. Well, he obviously believed this, but, you know, he came to see the truth of it later on. You actually say, you know, God has wronged me. That's quite a position to be in, isn't it? God has wronged me. God's not just. God's a bully. God shows no pity. God hates me. Anyway, he says here, God has wronged me and has surrounded me with his net. That's probably a playback to an earlier verse where Bildad says that the wicked are caught in a net by their own feet. So, you know, Bildad's view was wicked people end up trapped in their own mischief. Their own net catches them. And Job says, no, no, I'm caught by God's net. It wasn't me stumbling into a net. God did this. Notice verses 8 through 12. "He has fenced up my way so that I cannot pass. He has set darkness in my paths. He has stripped me of my glory and taken the crown from my head. He breaks me down on every side and I'm gone. My hope, he is uprooted like a tree. He has also kindled his wrath against me. He counts me as one of his enemies. His troops come together and build up their road against me. They encamp all around my tent. God is after me." Big time. Verse 21 through 29. "Have pity on me. Have pity on me, O you, my friends. For the hand of God has struck me. Why do you persecute me as God does? And are not satisfied with my flesh?" You know, God's persecuting me. Do you have to join him? Verse 23. "Oh, that my words were written. Oh, that they were inscribed in a book. That they were engraved on a rock with an iron pen and lead forever." Actually, of course, Job, you got your wish. He says, verse 23, "Oh, my words were written down and inscribed in a book." Well, they are. They are. We've got them. We're reading them. Might be a bit embarrassing to Job in the resurrection when he is reminded of what he said about God, but okay, none of us is perfect. So yeah, these things are written down. Verse 25, "For I know that my Redeemer lives, and he shall stand at last on the earth." Another sort of hint here of Job's vague understanding of what the future would look like. Verse 25, "For I know that my Redeemer lives, and he shall stand at last on the earth," which, of course, we might recognize as a famous aria from the Messiah, Handel's Messiah, one of the arias that the lead soprano sings, a nice piece of music. "I know that my Redeemer lives. He shall stand at last on the earth, and after my skin is destroyed, this I know, that in my flesh, or possibly out of my flesh, I shall see God, whom I shall see for myself, and my eyes shall behold, and not another. How my heart yearns within me for those days so he can see. It looks like he can see a time, perhaps far off in the future, when he will see God face to face with his own eyes. And of course, that's true. He will. Verse 28, if you should say, how shall we persecute him, since the root of the matter come to you is found in me, be afraid of the sword for yourselves, my three friends. For wrath brings the punishment of the sword, that you may know there is a judgment. Just saying, you guys better watch out yourselves what you say, otherwise it might come back and bite you lot. Job 23, verses 1 through 7. Then Job answered and said, even today my complaint is bitter. My hand is listless because of my groaning. Oh, that I knew where I might find him, that I might come to his seat. I present my case before him and fill my mouth with arguments. So he just wishes he knew how to track God down. If I knew where God was, if I could track down God, I'd get my case put together, the reasons why, the reasons against, and I'd go before God and I'd present my case and we'd see who's just and who's unjust. And verse 5, I would know the words which he would answer me and understand what he would say to me. Would he contend with me in his great power? No, but he would take note of me. There the upright could reason with him, namely me, and I would be delivered forever from my judge. If I could just get to God and sort of stand in front of him and present my legal case and seek justice, an upright person would be judged properly, which I am, if I could only get there. Verses 10 through 12. But he knows the way that I take. He's thinking, well, I'd have to go there and see God because God knows already what I'm like. I don't have to tell God, do I? He knows. He knows the way that I take. When he has tested me, I shall come forth as gold. My foot has held fast to his steps. I have kept his way and not turned aside. I have not departed from the commandment of his lips. I have treasured the words of his mouth more than my necessary food. He just says, but just a minute, I've always lived right. I've never departed from the commandments of God. I don't know what words Job actually had available to him at the time, but he says, I've treasured the words of his mouth more than my necessary food. So I go God's way. I keep God's ways. Almost, why should I have to go to God and present my case when he surely knows already what a good person I am? Right? Job 27. And Job finishes in chapter 31, so we're getting towards the end of Job's defense. Verses 1 to 6 of chapter 27. Moreover, Job continued his discourse and said, as God lives, who has taken away my justice, and the Almighty has made my soul bitter. You know, God's been unjust to me, unfair. It's illegal what God's doing. As long as my breath is in me, and the breath of God in my nostrils, my lips will not speak wickedness, nor my tongue utter deceit. Far be it from me that I should say you are right. Till I die, I will not put away my integrity from me. My righteousness I hold fast and will not let it go. My heart shall not reproach me as long as I live. And the man was exceedingly confident. Now, some might say self-righteous. I don't really buy that. Job was just presenting the fact that he had a horrific experience, losing his family, his wealth, his health. He was in agony and pain and skin peeling off, and he just knew categorically, I have not been a bad person. And he says here, you know, till I die, I will not put away my integrity from me. and my righteousness I hold fast. I will not let it go, no matter what you guys keep telling me. And this is what he's getting back to them, of course. He's debating with these three friends who say, you're a wicked man. You deserve worse than what you got. You must be a terrible sinner. And he says, wrong. I don't care how much you pile all this nonsense on me. I am a good man. And I'll die before I say otherwise. And of course, remember, Job chapter 1, God said just the same. So I don't think this is Job trying to appear super holy and super righteous. He's just being honest against people who are accusing him of every known sin that man could, you know, commit. They think he's done. verse 11 through 23. I will teach you about the hand of God. What is with the Almighty I will not conceal. Surely all of you have seen it. Why then do you behave with complete nonsense? I'll tell you what God does. Verse 13. This is the portion of a wicked man with God, and the heritage of oppressors received from the Almighty. This is what God does to wicked people. If his children are multiplied, it is for the sword, and his offspring shall not be satisfied with bread. Those who survive him shall be buried in death, and their widows shall not weep. You know, God does this to wicked people. Though he heaps up silver like dust, the wicked person, and piles up clothing like clay, he may pile it up, but the just will wear it, and the innocent will divide the silver. The wicked person builds his house like a moth, like a booth that a watchman makes. The rich will lie down, but not be gathered up. He opens his eyes, and he is no more. Terrors overtake him, the wicked person, like a flood. A tempest steals him away in the night. The east wind carries him away, and he is gone. It sweeps him out of his place. It hurls against him and does not spare. He flees desperately from its power. Men shall clap their hands at him, and shall hiss him out of his place. This is what God does to wicked people. But of course, Job's not a wicked person. So in a sense, why would any of that be happening to him? Doesn't make any sense. Job 29, verses 1 through 12. So Job starts to recount his earlier life before all of his troubles arrived. Job further continued his discourse and said, oh, that I were as in months past, as in the days when God watched over me, when his lamp shone upon my head, when by his light I walked through darkness, just as I was in the days of my prime, when the friendly counsel of God was over my tent, when the Almighty was yet with me, when my children were around me, when my steps were bathed with cream and the rock poured out rivers of oil for me. He's harking back to perhaps a year or two or three earlier. When I went out to the gate by the city, when I took my seat in the open square, the young men saw me and hid. The aged arose and stood. The princes refrained from talking, put their hand on their mouth. The voice of nobles was hushed, and the tongue stuck to the roof of their mouth. When they heard, then it blessed me. When the ear heard, it blessed me. When the eye saw, it approved me. So he's remembering the days when he was highly regarded, very respected. Even aged people, young people, stopped when Job arrived because this is Job, the great man with wisdom. Verse 12, because I delivered the poor who cried out, and the fatherless, and he who had no helper. So he's a really, really good man. Notice verses 21 to 22. Men listened to me and waited and kept silence for my counsel. After my words, they did not speak again, and my speech settled on them as dew. So he was such a wise man and highly regarded that, you know, his view was final. So he was a top guy. Verse 25, I chose the way for them and sat as chief. So I dwelt as a king in the army, as one who comforts mourners. So again, he's recounting the days when he was a very honoured individual, sitting almost like a king and not talking about it in a proud sense. He was a very good guy. He did good. But of course, things have changed, haven't they? But now, chapter 30, verse 1, but now, those are those days, but now, they mock at me, men younger than I, whose fathers I disdain to put with the dogs of my flock. These are ruffians. Their dads were rough. And this is the offspring of the rough guys. Verses 8 through 10. They were sons of fools. Yes, sons of vile men. They were scourged from the land. We drove them out. They're horrible, nasty, brutish people. And now I am their taunt song. I am their byword. They, these sons of vile men, they abhor me. They keep far from me. They don't hesitate to spit in my face. So rather than being honoured and respected by the young and the old and treated almost like a king, a man of great wisdom, now even the sons of vile men spit at me, make songs and jokes about me. How his life has changed. Verse 16 through 23. And now my soul is poured out because of my plight. The days of affliction take hold of me. My bones are pierced in me at night, and my gnawing pains take no rest. By great force my garment is disfigured. It binds about me as the collar of my coat. He has cast me into the mire, into the mud, and I become like dust and ashes. I cry out to you, God, but you do not answer me. I stand up. And you just stare at me. Don't do anything. But you have become cruel to me. Oops. all that my words might be written down. Well, they were written down, Job, and we're reading them. And they're just a little bit embarrassing. But you have become cruel to me. With the strength of your hand, you oppose me. You lift me up to the wind and cause me to ride on it. You're blowing me away. You spoil my success. For I know that you will bring me to death and to the house appointed for all living. I'm dying. And I suppose he said earlier, the quicker the better. Verses 25 to 30. Have I not wept for him who was in trouble? Talking what he used to do. Has not my soul grieved for the poor? That's what I did. When I was wealthier and in a position to help, I did so. But when I looked for good, evil came to me. When I waited for light, then came darkness. My heart is in turmoil and cannot rest. Days of affliction confront me. I go about mourning, but not in the sun. I stand up in the congregation and cry for help, but of course none ever came. I am a brother of jackals, a companion of ostriches. My skin grows black and falls from me. My bones burn with fever. So he's in a bad way, isn't he? I'm getting no encouragement and no support from anybody. And so Job comes to his last part of his own discourse in Job chapter 31. So we'll finish pretty much, with this. Job 31. It's his final defense. He's come to the end of what he's able to say. Job 31, verses 2 to 12. For what is the allotment of God from above, an inheritance of the Almighty from on high? Is it not destruction for the wicked and disaster for the workers of iniquity? Does he not see my ways and count all my steps? Surely God can see that I'm not wicked. If I've walked with falsehood, or if my foot has hastened to deceit, let me be weighed in a just balance, that God may know my integrity. If my step is turned from the way, or my heart walked after my eyes, was covetous, if any spot adheres to my hands, then let me sow and another eat. Yes, let my harvest be rooted out. If I've done bad things, fair enough. Job's just saying, look, if I've been wicked, if I've been false, if I've been deceitful, if I've turned to wrong ways, fair enough. Let me, live with the consequences. Verse 9, if my heart has been enticed by a woman, or I've lurked at my neighbor's door, thinking of adultery, then let my wife grind for another, let others bow down over her, for that would be wickedness. It would be iniquity worthy of judgment, for that would be a fire that consumes to destruction and would root out all my... If I've engaged in adultery, done evil things like that, fine. You know, I'm happy to reap the consequences of terrible behavior. What he's struggling with is how come he's good? This is happening. Verses 16 and 17. If I have kept the poor from their desire, or caused the eyes of the widow to fail, or eaten my morsel by myself so that the fatherless may not eat of it, if I'm being greedy and selfish, fine. Deal with me. Verses 19 to 22. If I have seen anyone perish for lack of clothing, or any poor man without covering, if his heart has not blessed me, if he was not warmed with the fleece of my sheep, if I have raised my hand against the fatherless when I saw I had help in the gate, then, fair enough, let my arm fall from my shoulder, let my arm be torn from the socket. For destruction from God is a terror to me, and because of his magnificence I could not endure. Again, if I've been, you know, treated the poor badly and the fatherless badly, I get it. I would accept that. Verse 24 through 28. If I've made gold my hope, or said to find gold, you are my confidence, you know, put not your trust in material goods. But if he'd done that, if I've rejoiced because my wealth was great, because my hand had gained much, right? If I was after money, fine, I could accept the consequences. Verse 26, if I've observed the sun when it shines, meaning to worship it, you know, to honour it, in other words, to have false gods. If I've observed the sun when it shines, or the moon moving in brightness, so that my heart has been secretly enticed, and my mouth has kissed my hand, this also would be an iniquity worthy of judgment. For I would have denied God who is above. If I'd turned my heart to the sun and the moon to worship them, it says here, my mouth has kissed my hand. That's like blowing a kiss. You know, you sort of kiss your hand and waft it up towards the moon to honour the moon. Well, if I'd done those things, I would have denied God. I deserve everything I get. He's not saying otherwise. He's just saying, but I didn't do any of those things. Verse 33, 34. If I have covered my transgressions as Adam, by hiding my iniquity in my bosom, because I feared the great multitude and dreaded the contempt of families, so that I kept silence and did not go out the door. If I hid these things and did it all in secret, again, God could deal with me. I'd have to accept that. But he knows he hasn't. Verse 35. Oh, that I had one to hear me. Here is my mark. Oh, that the Almighty would answer me, that my prosecutor had written a book. Now, he's getting to the end of his views here. He says, oh, that God would hear me. And I think he means in a judicial sense. Here is my mark. And that apparently in the Hebrew has got legal implications. It means, here is my defense. Here is my legal pleading. Here is my case. Here is my position. Or here is my mark. And when you've got your mark, you now await for your adversary to come to trial with you. Or that my prosecutor had written a book, talking of God, in which the detailed charges would appear. So what he's getting to is he's saying, look, it's time for God to hear me. I've set my defense here. I've set my mark. It's time for God to answer me. And I wish my prosecutor would write down the details of the charges against me. Verse 36, surely I would carry it on my shoulder and bind it on me like a crown. I would declare to him the number of my steps like a prince. I would approach him. And he more or less saying, look, if God put the charges against me in a book, I'd be quite confident it would show me to be clean and innocent. No charges in a book could stand against me. I would wear any such accusations on my shoulder triumphantly. My head would be held high like a prince, because there's nothing that God could put in a charge book against me that would stand. The guy is extremely confident. He must have been really a really, really good guy. Hence he can defend his innocence, his honesty, his generosity to this sort of level. And God said earlier on, Job is a perfect and upright man who fears God and shuns evil. And partly that was true. And Job knew it was true. And even if God put it into a charge book, there'd be nothing there, says Job. I'd still have my head held high because there'd be nothing that God could hold against me. Verses 38 to 40. Even with regard to the land he had, Job was a good man. If my land cries out against me and its furrows weep together, if I've eaten its fruit without money or caused its owners to lose their lives, then let thistles grow instead of wheat and weeds instead of barley. But, you know, I'd accept the consequences if I'd done that, but I haven't. And the words of Job are ended. Thank heavens for that. That's 9 chapters of Job's friends and 20 chapters of Job all basically talking a load of nonsense. Chapter 32, verse 1, we'll just sort of read that. So these three men ceased answering Job because he was righteous in his own eyes. Actually, of course, he was righteous in God's eyes too. Right? So the debate comes to an end. They can't convince Job because they've got no evidence of the great wickedness that they continually accused him of. They keep saying, you must be wicked. You just must. Because God only punishes really wicked people. And he's really punishing you. You must be really, really wicked. And Job's response was, well, show me where. Give me one tiny example of this wickedness that you're on about. And of course, you know, God had said, you know, Job was blameless and upright, one who fears God and shuns evil. So actually, Job's friends could never have found anything in Job's life because there wasn't anything. And of course, Job had maintained his innocence. So we saw that because he couldn't think of anything particularly serious in his life that would get God on his case. But he made a number of quite serious accusations against God, didn't he? There's a Bible called Dake's Bible, D-A-K-E, an American guy that lived in the 1930s, 40s, I guess, 50s. And he's got one of his own, it's King James Version Bible, but it's called Dake's Annotated Bible because he's got tens of thousands of commentaries in it. And in it, in the book of Job, he lists 74 false charges that Job makes against God. 74. So he's counted them all and, you know, listed them all. 74 false charges that Job made against God. That's quite a lot. For example, the ones that we read, some of the ones that we read, he says that God multiplies wounds without cause. He says that God destroys the blameless as well as the wicked. He said that God laughs at the trouble of the innocent. He said, if I sin, God won't forgive me. He said, God hates me. He said, God has wronged me. He says, God shows no justice. And God is cruel. Oops. So, well, you know, Job has spent many chapters libeling God, slandering God, and defaming God. He was sincere, and he was actually a good guy. But he said a lot of things that were pretty, pretty stupid. Next week, we'll turn to be the last, episode of our review of the book of Job. So we'll end it next week. But next week, we'll see what happens when God turns up and starts to deal with Job. But that will be in a week's time. So for today, we'll conclude the Bible study at this point.